tasked with his mission of defenestrating government and driving out those that Donald Trump sees as enemies. Trump won the election and has a mandate for change, and these and other pigs are proof of a president-elect who is increasingly powerful and cares little for the critics who warn his second term poses a threat to the rule of law. Trump's shortly former first-term communications director Anthony Scaramucci told CNN that the president-elect's personal selections were purposefully meant to own the liberals. Paraphrasing Trump's intent, Scaramucci added, "Let's pick some triggering people, and those are the triggering people." Pennsylvania's Democratic Senator John Fetterman agreed, telling CNN Matt Gaetz's selection will lead to a meltdown. Gaetz, who had been under a House Ethics Committee investigation, resigned from Congress last Wednesday in the wake of Donald Trump's announcement. The committee, which had been probing allegations that he engaged in sexual misconduct and illegal drug use, accepted improper gifts, dispensed special privileges and favors to individuals with whom he had a personal relationship, and sought to obstruct government investigations into his conduct, was due to meet this week to vote on releasing a report, potentially as soon as Friday. With Matt Gaetz leaving Congress, it's unclear if the information will ever become public.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Eruba Shavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Representatives of the five member states of the Eurasian Economic Union, namely Russia, Belarus, Kazakhstan, Armenia, and Kyrgyzstan, along with the chairman of Iran's Trade Promotion Organization and Iran's ambassador to Russia, held a meeting to coordinate the third exclusive exhibition of Eurasia in Iran later in February.
Very good field for cooperating between two countries, business of two countries, and actually we would like to thank the organizers of this event, and I believe that will be this platform will be the good platform for cooperating and increasing our turnover between our two countries.
The Islamic Republic of Iran offers great potential as one of the major economic powers in the region. Our goal should be to pinpoint nations that we can collaborate with. The Eurasian Economic Union offers many opportunities, particularly taking Russia into consideration. Currently, Iran is serving as a hub for Russian goods.
Expo 2025 is a unique platform that can help introduce Iran's industrial capabilities and market opportunities to businessmen and industrialists of EEU member states.
Considering our strong historical and cultural ties with EEU member states, we can certainly benefit from the participation of Eurasian member countries in the upcoming exhibition.
The Eurasia Economic Union is the biggest union neighboring Iran. Both Iran and its member countries can make the most of the opportunities this union can provide.
Collaborating with the nations in the region is in accordance with the economic policies of Iran. The EU is the most important union in our region. The North-South Corridor is a strategic international transit route that can provide the EU access to the international waters.
Participants believe cooperation between Iran and the EU can help boost Iran's economy.
The EU offers the opportunity to Iran to expand its business relations despite Western sanctions. Particularly in technical fields such as engineering, we can offer our services to these countries.
Iran has already signed a free trade agreement with three of the EU member states.
The trade volume of the EU is approximately $900 billion. Iranian companies are hoping to benefit from a substantial share of this opportunity.
In line with its economic interests, Iran is currently looking forward to gaining observer status in the EU.
The Eurasia Expo 2025 serves as a platform for Iranian companies to present their capabilities, potentially leading to free trade with Eurasian Economic Union member countries. Mehdi Nourouzi, Tehran.
The Yemeni armed forces announced the targeting of Israel's military and vital sites in Tel Aviv and Ashkelon, striking areas deep within the occupied Palestine. Using a fleet of drones, the Yemeni military says the operation achieved all its objectives, underscoring its growing drone warfare capabilities. This latest strike has been described as a response to what Yemeni officials call injustices faced by the Palestinian and Lebanese people.
In the absence of other aerial weapons, the Yemeni armed forces achieved great success in using drones as a primary weapon. This indicates that the Yemeni army is able to prepare appropriate plans. The Israeli enemy is in a state of anxiety and terror, and sirens are blaring everywhere. Today, it is unable to protect its cities, ports, and strategic sites.
Ansarullah top official Mohammed al-Houthi did not mince words. Declaring the United States as weak as straw, he dismissed any potential return of Donald Trump to power as inconsequential, suggesting that U.S. policies are to remain unchanged. He also highlighted Yemen's victories over U.S. naval forces as evidence of their resilience, attributing these successes to faith and the teachings of the Holy Quran.
The Yemeni armed forces has carried out operations against multiple Israeli targets, including ships and cities occupied by the regime. And let's not forget the targeting of the Abraham Lincoln aircraft carrier and warships, all of which are considered a qualitative leap, whether in obtaining intelligence or improving the weaknesses of the Western military technologies.
Meanwhile, the American National Interest magazine has echoed concerns about the vulnerability of U.S. naval fleets, citing Yemeni drone and missile capabilities as unprecedented challenges. Even the Pentagon has acknowledged the effectiveness of these tactics. This has left military analysts questioning the future of naval warfare in the region.
As Yemen steps further into the spotlight with its continued drone and missile operations against Israel and its backers, it's evident the dynamics of this conflict are rapidly changing. From the heart of Sana'a, the message from Yemen is one of defiance and determination. Abdul Latif Loshali, Sana'a.
The relentless Israeli attacks continue to devastate the southern suburb of the Lebanese capital and started expanding towards the central areas of the city. After several days of relative calm last week, there has been a surge of over 50 airstrikes since Tuesday. These strikes, primarily targeting Dahi, have resulted in the destruction of entire buildings. The documented footage reveals that the weapons used were MK-84 bombs, which are US-made and weigh 1 ton. These explosives were equipped with U.S. Joint Direct Attack Munition Guidance Kits, or JDAMs, allowing for precise strikes.
The damage caused by the latest airstrikes goes beyond the targeted buildings and have caused damage to entire blocks and resulted in destruction on a large scale under the false claim of precision strikes. The regime has not presented any evidence linking the targeted buildings to military activity. Some of the buildings were even well-known public medical centers. This comes after some Israeli media confirmed that the war cabinet agreed on increasing attacks on Lebanon.
Lebanese journalist and security analyst Ali Jizzini commented on the latest developments.
The number of Israeli airstrikes against the capital city of Beirut, Andahya, have increased significantly in the last few days. This comes within the framework of waging a psychological warfare against the Lebanese people, the people who support the resistance, to try to separate between the two entities. Also, it comes within the framework of the policy or the strategy of maximum pressure against the resistance and the Lebanese negotiators to push for terms that are more favorable to the Israelis. So since the Israelis are facing difficulties now in advancing on multiple axes in the south of Lebanon, and they're facing several problems, technical problems, problems that come with mobilization and the war exhaustion, they're resorting to choices that are cost-efficient for them, even if it means conducting air raids, terroristic actions, and actions that go against the international law.
Lebanese people are aware that these strikes aim to target public morale and that Israel is attempting to exert more pressure over the people, of which almost 1.4 million are now internally displaced. The Israeli cabinet, which seems incapable of achieving any of its political or military goals against the resistance in Lebanon, relies on destroying people's homes and stores in order to sell their settlers fake achievements. But since the missiles and drones of the resistance are still hitting Israeli colonies and military bases daily, it is not likely that anyone in the Israeli entity will buy it. From Lebanese capital Beirut, Hadi Htayb.
The strike aims to express solidarity with the Palestinian people and draw attention to the urgent need for action as the humanitarian crisis in northern Gaza intensifies due to the ongoing genocide and forced displacement.
I am on a hunger strike for 15 days, driven solely by a humanitarian cause. Our demand is clear. We urge the international community to ensure the delivery of aid to northern Gaza. To the people of Gaza, my message is simple. We stand with you, unwavering in solidarity.
The core principle behind our hunger strike is solidarity with our brothers and sisters in Gaza, who have been deprived of aid for 40 days. Through this strike, we share their pain, experiencing the very same hardships they endure. Our demand is straightforward: the delivery of aid to our brothers and sisters in Gaza.
As the strike enters its third week, the health of the hunger strikers has worsened, with a growing number of fainting cases and dangerously low blood sugar levels, prompting the transfer of some strikers to hospitals for treatment.
The health of those who began their strike 15 days ago, including myself and others here, has severely deteriorated. We are experiencing fatigue and weakness, relying solely on water mixed with salt. Some individuals have already been transferred to hospitals for medical care.
In the middle of famine and the starvation happening before our eyes in Gaza, a group of guys, young guys and girls in Jordan, start this hunger strike to support the Palestinian in Gaza and asking for support and need to save their lives in Gaza. Here in the Association Against Zionism and Racism, we are doing our duty to host this group of young guys and girls and support their standing.
Organizers report a surge in participation, with more youths joining in recent days, as the strike enters its third week, highlighting a growing interest among a broad segment of Jordanian youth to take part. As the number of young hunger strikers grows, several movements have expressed support by providing them with headquarters. Their solidarity reflects a united Jordanian stance on the Palestinian cause. Zaid Agarbe, Amman.
Another pro-Palestine rally in the South Korean capital.
Protest chants demanding the liberation of Palestine echoed across downtown Seoul on Saturday. Many young people participated in the rally ahead of International Children's Day, November the 20th. Even in grade 5, Chun Shiwan understands the harsh reality of Israeli atrocities and the Americans' complicity.
We must condemn Israel, and when we condemn Israel, we must also condemn the United States, because the United States has been providing Israel with weapons and bombs and helps the regime slaughter innocent civilians. And therefore, the United States is also a terrorist.
Supporters of Palestine here were recently called in for questioning by South Korean prosecutors, just like pro-Palestine activists are targeted in Europe.
We are now living in an unprecedented time of expression of global support for the liberation of Palestine. Criminalizing our voice will not quiet it. Let our voice be louder than the voice of the oppressor.
The facts of Israel's atrocities cannot be denied. A recent report by a special committee of the United Nations released on Thursday puts on the record what supporters of Palestinians have been stating for several months. Israel, through its indiscriminate assaults and obstruction of aid, is, quote, using starvation as a weapon of war, imposing collective punishment on the Palestinian people. The UN report also said the term genocide may apply. International activists want to help Palestinians stay strong.
Palestinians have been resisting Israeli occupation for the past 76 years and suffering genocide for over a year. These demonstrations around the world will make Palestinians understand they are not alone, and we are together and fighting for the human rights of the Palestinian people.
More civic actions are planned, including International Human Rights Day, December 8th. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Nurses and midwives in Sydney organized a weekend fundraiser to support those affected by the ongoing conflict in Gaza and Lebanon. Their event sought to raise essential funds, offering much-needed aid and relief to war-stricken communities.
The West's silence and complicity in the Israeli war crimes committed in Palestine and Lebanon have driven people to seek alternative ways to support these oppressed. This event is one such initiative by Australians.
Scores of small businesses owned by Palestinian Australians and Lebanese Australians joined the fundraising campaign, contributing to the effort with unwavering dedication. Business owners emphasized the importance of collective action, stating that every effort, no matter how small, is vital in supporting what is just and right.
We need these events to bring us all together, just as human beings who can see something wrong, want to keep identifying that it's wrong, and want to keep that narrative in the front of the community's minds, not allow the media and the government to bury these issues.
Mohammed Zarka, a Palestinian Australian who owns a popular kanafa business in Sydney, has a deeply personal connection to the cause. His grandfather was forced out of Jerusalem during the Nakba, leaving the family to live in various countries, but never in their homeland.
Very proud.
In an emotional journey to reconnect with his roots, Mohammed Zarka visited his ancestral home in Palestine. While his grandfather's house and orange tree still stands, he was not allowed to pick its fruit.
My grandfather told me there's a tree there he planted when he was young. It's an orange tree. So I went inside to look for it. So I found it, this big orange tree. And I found, wow, that's the one. So I grabbed some of the orange I'm going to bring back to my grandfather. And the lady came up to me, she said, oh, you're stealing my orange. I said, hello, this is not your orange. That's my orange. It's my grandfather's orange tree.
Mohammed remains hopeful, believing that one day Palestine will be free.
She said, please, please, come in, go, come out. I said, okay, wait. I want to hug that tree. So I hugged the tree, I kissed the tree, and I talked to the tree. I said, darling, it's okay. I'm coming back soon.
Since October 2023, weekend events in support of Gaza and Lebanon have become a powerful and consistent movement across Australia.
Humanitarian groups are leaving no stone unturned from advocating for sanctions against Israel to raising critical funds for aid. Their collective efforts reflecting a growing demand for justice and unwavering solidarity with those impacted by the ongoing conflict. Shahana Bhatt, Sydney.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is part of the speech delivered by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the members of the sixth session of the Assembly of Experts of the Leadership. The meeting took place in Imam Khomeini Husseiniya on November 7th, 2024. The Quran warns that if you become negligent or obey the unbelievers, you will turn back, regress, and slip into a state of decline. In the noble Surah Al-Baqarah, they will not cease fighting you till they turn you away from your religion if they can. Chapter 2, verse 217. And in another noble verse in the same surah, it states, Many of the people of the book are eager to turn you into unbelievers after your faith. Chapter 2, verse 109. Hence, this issue of regression, stagnation, and turning back is not a trivial matter. It is a very significant issue, and the Holy Quran has addressed it. We have witnessed such cases in recent history, and we have also seen them in the past. An element is necessary to prevent this regression. In the Islamic system, this element is the position of the leader. Such a deviation must be prevented by a leader. This is very important. It is very important. Therefore, the importance of the Assembly of Experts is because appointing the person responsible for this mission is a very important matter.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
In other words, the Assembly of Experts is responsible for appointing the country's leader. That's why it's so important. That's why I said the Assembly of Experts is among the most revolutionary institutions. Conceptually, this is its position. But in specific instances, various situations may arise. Sometimes its actions may be in accord with this concept, and sometimes they may not. Similarly, in the case of the leadership, there may be times when it can fulfill its role and other times when it cannot. Of course, regarding leadership, not wanting to do something is not an option. It's more about whether it can be done or cannot be done. There is another crucial point regarding the responsibility of the Assembly of Experts, which is that the establishment and creation of the Assembly of Experts signifies the uninterrupted progress of the Islamic system. This means that there will be no pause or interruption in the system. The Assembly of Experts exists to be able to designate a successor. Therefore, this succession will continue with full strength, power, and ability.
you've got. You've got for me through all my years I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
Option for today and a better tomorrow. IRIB English Radio. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
In a press conference hours ago, the Director General of the International Atomic Energy Agency, Rafael Grossi, described his recent visit to Iran as thorough and productive. He maintains, however, that the agency will wait for Iran's next steps, as it believes in the maxim, trust but verify, and that the E3's fourth resolution against Iran is on the table. The voting on the resolution takes place tomorrow, but regardless of the outcome, what will this mean in terms of Iran's relationship with the IAEA? In tonight's Spotlight, we are going to discuss Iran's relations with the IAEA. Allow me to introduce my guest, Ayan Bahman-Urey. Daniel Kovalik, author and human rights lawyer from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And John Bosnich, journalist, activist and political analyst, who is joining us from Fredericton. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. I appreciate your time. I'm going to start with Daniel. Well, what does exactly this European stance mean? Why are they deciding to go confrontational right now at this moment where talks promise more positive outcomes regarding Iran's further cooperation with the IAEA?
Well, I mean, I think they're taking the lead from the United States, which wants confrontation with Iran, that's pushing for confrontation with Iran, and so that's why they're taking this stance now. Of course, it has to be pointed out that while Iran doesn't even have nuclear weapons, Israel, which is in the neighborhood, does and hasn't even declared them, which itself is a violation of the Non-Proliferation Treaty. Obviously this is just a matter of aggression at this point.
Right, and now, John, Iran's foreign minister said the visit of Grossi to Iran was a sign of goodwill and commitment of Tehran to further improve the relation between Iran and IAEA. But what was this trip? What was it, a formality? You know, why hasn't it made any effective change in the European position?
Well, I think I have to agree right away with your other commentator today that this is just another of the landmines that the Biden administration in specific is setting for incoming President Donald Trump. There's no doubt that the existing administration in the United States is trying to disrupt everything it can with respect to the upcoming presidency of Donald Trump. Donald Trump himself has been hard on Iran, but I believe that that is because he wants to pull off the deal of the century and find a peaceful solution. But Biden's administration wants to sabotage everything they can. They are definitely involved in the sabotaging of the future administration. They were behind the bombing of the gas line between Russia and Germany. They are participating in everything they can to create a warlike environment that will tie up the Trump administration even before he takes office. So this is more American chicanery, and I think that we could trace this directly back to Biden's administration and specifically to his Secretary of State.
John, you know, I'm going to stick with you right now. It seems that we are seeing a pattern here. You know, it seems that the IAEA is taking positions solely based on what the collective West actually desires. So could we say that this international body is actually losing its function?
This international body lost its function a long time ago, and I'd like to say there's no such thing as the collective West. The collective West is actually translated into common English as America and its occupied NATO colonies. These are not independent countries. These are, like the Roman Empire had, these are federati, or federated states, which do what they're told by the big boss in Washington, who is advised by the jokers in London. That's the way the world is run. The so-called international community are nothing more than a groveling group of occupied Anglo-American colonies by occupying forces which sit on their territory till today. Germany, today, 80 years after World War II, is an occupied country. Japan is an occupied country. And the rest of Western Europe is occupied territory, which the United States is just pushing left and right as they wish to further their interests of empire. And I think that the outgoing Biden administration in particular is a serious warmonger administration and wants to mine and lay minefields for the Trump administration even before he comes into office, because they know that he has presented himself as the anti-war president, and so they are trying to provoke war in any way that they can.
Well, my question for Daniel right now is that could Iran trigger its right under Article 10 of the NPT, because it clearly says, quote, it can withdraw from the treaty if the withdrawing party decides that extraordinary events related to the subject matter of this treaty have jeopardized the supreme interest of this country. So could Iran actually go in that direction now?
Well, it could have a long time ago. Again, the nuclear talks and agreements that Iran has entered into, and they've done so in order to peace with the United States, to try to end the crushing economic sanctions against them by the United States. They've never been honored by the other side. Iran honors the agreements, but then the U.S. doesn't honor the agreement for its part. You know, Obama was supposed to lift all sanctions against Iran. He never did that. And then, of course, Trump unilaterally pulled out of the nuclear deal and imposed even more crushing sanctions, which the Biden administration has continued. So I would say, indeed, that this agreement that they have at this point is self-defeating, and it makes no sense for them to be a part of. However, I don't think they will leave it, and that is because they are doing anything they can to keep the peace. They want peace with the United States. They want peace with Europe. And they're willing to play ball even when they know that they are going to get the short end of the stick.
Right. But if Iran doesn't do that, what will be Iran next step? Because we have heard the foreign minister saying that if such resolution is passed, we're going to take a proportionate response and proportionate measures. What do you think could be a proportionate response to this?
To what in particular?
To this new resolution that is probably going to be passed tomorrow.
Yeah, I'm not sure what kind of response we can expect. I mean, look, I think the one thing people are waiting for is to hear whether Iran is going to announce that it's a nuclear state, you know, in response not only to this, but also to Israel's, of course, constant threats, which, you know, always have in them the veiled threat of a nuclear attack. So maybe in response they'll pull out again, maybe declare they're a nuclear state. We'll see. But that's certainly one possibility, and if that happens, it'll be because they've been pushed in.
Right. John, you mentioned that the Biden administration is kind of setting up landmines for the Trump administration, which is coming. What do you think will be the positioning of the new government of Donald Trump regarding this? Could this new government have anything to do or something to do with this new resolution at the IAEA in support of it?
Well, I think that we are not going to see much cooperation between Trump and Biden. As much as they may share some foreign policy objectives as a part of the enmity between Biden's administration and the Trump administration is extreme. The only factor that might have a commonality here is the influence of the Israel lobby. I think I've mentioned on these programs before that 40% of the funding for the Republican Party comes from the Israel lobby, and 60% of the funding for the Democratic Party comes from the Israel lobby, and therefore the Israel lobby is the string puller of U.S. politics. My personal opinion is that President Trump is going to try and untie his hands from that lobby when he takes office, and I think that that lobby is now trying to leverage Biden to put more pressure on Trump and keep him in their pocket. I don't know how this will go, but as a former government advisor, I would advise the government of Iran to do nothing that could be misrepresented as aggression on your part. The world knows that Israel is a nuclear power, major nuclear power, and nobody does anything about it. Anybody who's properly informed about this subject knows that Iran has complied with and followed to the letter the agreements about non-enrichment beyond a certain level. I really think that Iran has to play it calm and play it neutral and not be provoked, because this is obviously a blatant and naked effort to provoke Iran to do something that could be used against Iran. And I think Iran's politicians and leadership know this themselves and will not be tricked into doing anything that could be turned against them.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Daniel, in the press conference of Mr. Grossi, We could see that Mr. Grossi was very positive regarding his latest trip to Tehran and said that he met with the Iranian president. It was a very positive one. Actually, he was faced with questions like, you know, what was the result of it? Did you get any feasible outcome from the trip? Any actual promise from Tehran not to get involved with nuclear activities and everything? But he was very positive. At the same time, we're witnessing the E3 coming up with this resolution, and even Mr. Gross is saying that the resolution is on the table, waiting to be ratified. You know, I can see some sort of a contradiction there, don't you? What do you think? You know, is this a line of action provided for them and that they are supposed to move in? What is happening exactly?
Yeah, well, there is a contradiction, but again, Iran has been compliant with the IAEA and, again, with other nuclear agreements that it has. It continues to be compliant, but it is never rewarded for that, right? There's nothing it can do to prevent being censored in the way that they are by the West. And that's because the West sees them as a threat to their hegemony. And frankly, because the West, and in particular the U.S., still won't forgive them for overthrowing the U.S. installed in Back Shah in 1979. So it doesn't matter what they do. They will be censored by Europe. And it's a shame, you know, because the rules do not apply. The same rules do not apply to everyone. Again, the elephant in the living room is that the only nuclear state, that is a state with nuclear weapons, in West Asia is Israel. And they don't even allow the IAEA to visit and inspect their sites. And everyone pretends they don't have nuclear weapons when everyone knows they do. So it's not a matter of compliance. This is called selective enforcement and selective prosecution.
Well, John, as Daniel mentioned, Israel, what do you think is the role of Israel in the direction that the IAEA is moving towards?
This is obvious. The Israel lobby, which is directly beholden to Netanyahu, is trying to create disturbances that will deter people from talking about what Israel is doing in Gaza and the genocide that Israel is conducting. So we have a multifaceted problem here, all taking place at the same time. The warmongers in the United States are very upset that they're losing the war in Ukraine. They tried to poison the relationship between Russia and Europe by bombing the gas pipelines. Now, if they can create a disturbance with Iran, once again, they are diverting attention from what Israel is doing every single day against the Palestinian people. So all these aspects work together to try to bring the Biden administration to simply take orders from the Israel lobby, create a crisis, create problems for Trump, ruin his first introductory period as president, and cause a regional conflict that would sell more weapons and make more money for the oligarchs who see war as a business and who are strongly opposed to Donald Trump because his presidency is based on his promise of ending all of these forever wars. So in this situation, despite his rhetoric and his calling out of Iran over the past years, Donald Trump is the target of this situation. Donald Trump, like Iran, is a target of the warmongers who run the U.S. economy and the U.S. government, and this is all wrapped up in the Israel lobby and Netanyahu's effort to divert attention from the genocide that he is conducting against the Palestinians today. Complex, but transparent at the same time.
Right. Daniel, Iran even has showed willingness to put a seal, actually, to the 60% enriched uranium stockpile. What else could this organization, could this agency want? You know, what would they call cooperation?
Again, I'm not sure what Iran could do to get the IAEA to say that they're fully cooperating. And again, because it's operating, that organization is pretty much every other international organization, is being led by the United States. And so that they carry out the foreign policy aims of the United States, which in this case is very much anti-Iran. So I'm not sure what they could do beyond maybe destroying their own nuclear, technology, which why would they do that? Short of that, I don't think there's anything they could do to placate either the IAEA or the West, because it's not about the nuclear enrichment. It's never been about that. It's about Iran's sovereignty, its right to defend itself and to defend its allies, like the people of Gaza, like the people of Lebanon, and the West resents that.
Right, indeed. What is your take on this, John?
Well, I think that it's a good time for Iran to pick up the phone and to call the members of BRICS and to call the Russian president and to call the Chinese president and let them know that it needs some international support, which it deserves and should receive, and lobby these other organizations and these international leaders to speak out loudly and forcefully against any effort to provoke an unjustified and unsupportable war in the region. And I can tell you that if Iran had ever wanted to get nuclear weapons, they would certainly not waste their time extracting uranium on their own when they have access to, like other countries which are not supporting the U.S. empire, they have access to support from North Korea, which went straight ahead, announced its nuclear power, and tested nuclear weapons to finally stop the threats from the United States. So all options are on the table, but Iran has intelligently taken a very peaceful and very compromising road, and so that no one can say that they provoked some kind of a response from Biden, who would love nothing more than to poison the presidency of Donald Trump with an unnecessary war against a target that they have been demonizing for decades.
Daniel, the Israeli prime minister has been constantly threatening to target Iranian nuclear facilities, which is a clear violation of international law, because even in times of war, nobody is supposed to target another state's nuclear facilities. At the same time, we do not see any correct stance or any proper positioning taken by the IAEA. They are not even being seriously discussing the matter. What's your take on that?
Again, this shows the hypocrisy of that organization. It should be condemning that. It should be condemning the threats against Iran's nuclear sites. It should have been condemning the murder of Iran's nuclear scientists, which have occurred over the years. We know that Israel's behind that. And it should be condemning Israel for having undeclared nuclear weapons. But you see none of that. And it shows, again, the hypocrisy and illegitimacy, frankly, of that organization.
And, John, Iran is again showing a huge self-restraint in responding to the latest Israeli attack on its soil. What shouldn't it send a positive message to the international community? Because practically, if this is not cooperation, what will be?
You know, there's not a fair playing field here. Israel is using its financial power through the Israel lobby to bribe politicians in the United States. We know that. That's transparent. We know that. The absurdity of the situation draws not even a raised eyebrow in the Western media, which itself is totally controlled by the warmongers. We had, if you'll recall, when the Nord Stream gas pipeline was blown first thing that the lying mainstream media of the West said, that it looked like Russia had blown up their own pipeline. I mean, that was so stupid and so absurd that they stopped saying it quite quickly. But those of us who are in the media know that that was their first crazy theory. We know now that there is a real crisis inside the United States, and that is that the military-industrial complex, which is the major element of the U.S. economy, is facing a shutdown under Donald Trump. If this is the way that they can maintain their business, by killing innocent people, by supporting Israel doing their dirty work by bombing Iran, then they might try it again. Iran has to stand firm, and it has to prove, once again, even though it's innocent, it has to prove itself innocent. And this is very strange, because the United States is based on the concept that you are innocent unless proven guilty, and yet the way they treat Iran is that Iran is guilty unless proven innocent. So Iran and the people of Iran have to continue to suffer under this false demonization and under this pressure, and they have to once again prove themselves to be innocent by sitting back and letting the lies flow until finally the world comes to Iran's defense, which they should. And the BRICS countries are the key players who should do that defense, and they should expose what is being done against the truth, against justice, and against Iran. That's the only way to proceed, and I think Iranian politicians and leaders are taking a very measured and very logical, peaceful approach, and I think it's the best approach, at least for the time being, depending on how much more pressure the Biden administration puts on Iran through Anthony Blinken, who is also the key player, not just against Iran, but for the Israel lobby and against Russia in the war in Ukraine. This is how the U.S. government has been hijacked, and you are the victims of it.
Thank you so much, gentlemen. I wish we could go on, but we are running out of time. It was a pleasure to have you on the program, and thank you for your contribution. Daniel Kovalik, author and human rights lawyer, joining us from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Also, John Bosner, journalist, activist, and political analyst, joining us from Fredericton. Thank you. So this was another episode of Spotlight.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.